Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. We have a really special show for you today, a fascinating insight into what really took place in Ferguson. My guest today is Tom Jackson. Tom was the chief of police of Ferguson when the backlash took place, the protests, and the city burned. His perspective is incredible. You will hear the real story of what took place in Ferguson, and this is something that every American should hear. So because of the gravity of this particular interview, there won't be a segment on police story this week because of the length of this interview. But before we get to that, let's take a walk over to the briefing room, and I can give you my view from the blue.
The briefing room, headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
There was an incident that took place in Florida just a few weeks ago. What happened was the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department got a report of a stolen vehicle. They spotted this stolen vehicle. It had three female juveniles in it, and they attempted to make a stop on it. The driver and the passengers failed to stop. A short pursuit ensued, and then the officers shut down the pursuit because it was too dangerous. But they were trying to keep an eye on the vehicle. So although they shut down the pursuit, they were following from a safe distance, and the driver of the car lost control of it, went off the road and into a swampy pond, and the vehicle got 75 yards into this pond, and the police officers arrived on the scene as the car was sinking. So they got out of their vehicles, they called for help. There were a number of different units involved in this, and there was some dash cam footage of some of these deputies. A couple of the deputies they took their gun belts off and their shirts, and they tried to get into the water to get to the girls, but the water was so deep that they couldn't see anything. There was all kinds of undergrowth. It was really a dangerous situation, and they couldn't get to them. And what happened was the car sank, and the three juveniles drowned. Well, let's be clear that the officers did absolutely nothing wrong here. They had done everything correctly. They attempted to make a car stop. The vehicle took off. The car went off the road because of the driver's inattention and carelessness. And three girls lost their lives. But it wasn't the fault of the police. They didn't do anything. They were simply doing their jobs, and they couldn't get them out. But do you think that would stop the protests from taking place? Of course not. Now, the activists, for lack of a better word, are now protesting the police murder of these three girls. The police murder of these three girls. It's absolutely outrageous. In fact, I was called upon to comment on this very incident on the Dr. Drew show just about a week and a half ago. And I got to debate with the attorney for the families of these three girls. And let me make it really clear what she's trying to do. They're trying to stir up a controversy. This shouldn't be a controversy, and there's no doubt in my mind that the attorney is doing this because she sees a payday. They sue the police. The police, because it is a highly charged, now it's become a racial issue, they're hoping that they're just going to pay out. I hope that they don't do it. I'll tell you this. The sheriff, Sheriff Gutierrez, came out really strong. And he told exactly what took place. He released the dash cam video that they had. Some of the dash cam video shows different perspectives of the scene. And because there are some police officers that are not drenched, the activists and some of the media is calling the police liars that they didn't attempt to rescue these girls. Well, let's be clear about a couple things. Going into that water in any way would have been almost suicide because of the conditions that night. And the police don't have to commit suicide in order to try and save somebody. That's why it's called, when these amazing rescues take place, it's called above and beyond the call of duty for a reason. They don't have to go in and risk their very lives because of the actions of other people. So even the fact that they tried is a huge heroic attempt. And the fact that these activists and these protesters are demanding incredible demands. They're screaming, jail the killer cops. They demand that the black community have control of the police. I mean, it's the most absurd thing I ever heard. And this is the new normal for law enforcement. And these officers, these deputies, they did exactly what they should have done. Those three girls drowned because of their own criminal activity. They were serial criminals, even at the ages of 15 and 16. And while the parents are screaming and yelling about the police, I'd like to know why they didn't know where their children were at 3 o'clock in the morning while they were out joyriding in a stolen vehicle. So let's remember that there are consequences for our actions, and you are responsible for yourself. That's my view from the blue. And now let's get to the interview room. So let's go over to the interview room where I have a very special guest waiting. His name is Tom Jackson, and he was the chief of police in Ferguson, Missouri, when the now famous riots took place. And let me give you a little bit of background about Tom. He was a policeman in St. Louis for 31 years before he took the chief's job, and the last 12 of those as the commander of the St. Louis Drug Task Force. He was also a SWAT team supervisor, an airplane and helicopter instructor pilot, undercover detective, and hostage negotiator. And before that, he was a paramedic and assisted with writing several pieces of legislation, as well as testifying before the House and Senate on various topics. He's received numerous awards, including the Medal of Valor, Meritorious Service Citations, White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, recognition for Outstanding Task Force Commander, and the Distinguished Service Award from the director of that organization. He has a degree in associate's degree in applied life science, and also a Bachelor of Science in Criminal Justice Management, and he's a graduate of the 221st session of the FBI National Academy. So, Tom, thank you so much for appearing on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Your message is one that is vitally important for the men and women of law enforcement and also the people of this country to hear.
Well, thanks a lot for having me out, Randy. It's good to talk to you again.
So let's go back to just as a little bit of background for the listeners who are not familiar with Ferguson, they're just familiar with the name. You were the police chief there for how many years prior to this incident?
A little over 4 years.
And during that 4 years, can you describe a little bit about what the community was like and if there were any issues that appeared to be a precursor to the madness that took place?
No. Prior to this, and for a long time, Ferguson's been just one of those communities that was able to maintain its character throughout the years. And as the area changed and the metropolitan area built up around it, it was originally a railroad town, a railroad depot. And people have lived there and stayed there even as the area changes. It maintained its character and its neighborhoods. You know, the population was diverse, but it was friendly. We had 9 neighborhood associations that met on a regular basis, and I would regularly attend those, and I would send members of my staff to those. The council members would go, and fire chief, the public works director, all that stuff. You know, we were very involved in the community, and the community was very involved with us. I had a volunteers and police service organization that worked with us, and we had a good relationship. The city, you know, ran one of the most popular 5K, 10K runs in the region. We had a Twilight Ramble. In the city was everything from a horse farm to the world headquarters of Emerson Electric. It has the oldest operating organic farm west of the Mississippi. And it's just been a great community where people were always out and about and coming together for various events and really enjoying the character of the community.
Right. How many officers were on the agency?
Its authorized strength now is 55. I think we had about 53 at the time.
Okay. Well, that's a normal size police agency for that area of the country.
Sure. It's a small town. It's surrounded by other small towns, but that's about average for the population.
Yeah. It sounds to me like you embraced the ideals of community policing even before any of these issues started to appear.
Oh, of course, yeah. From the very beginning, the city of Ferguson was always involved in neighborhood policing. As a matter of fact, in 2010, because of a specific neighborhood policing initiative, we were first runner-up for All-American City. I think we lost to maybe El Paso. But for a number of years in a row, Ferguson held the designation of Playful City USA, which is hard to get. That's a parks and recreation kind of thing. And we had, a dozen parks throughout the city, water park, athletic fields and stuff.
So it sounds like it. And so it must have come as an incredible shock to you when after the shooting of Michael Brown, suddenly you and your entire agency is painted with some horrendous brush of racism.
Yeah, it was shocking, and I was amazed how quickly big politicians, state and federal politicians, how quickly they were able to throw us and law enforcement in general under the bus. They were just ready to proceed with the idea, as ridiculous as it sounded, the idea that a young police officer in the middle of a summer day just decided that he was going to gun somebody down in cold blood for no particular reason. As absurd as that sounds, they went ahead and the press perpetuated it, as well did the Justice Department, the United States Justice Department.
All right. Well, we'll get into that a little bit. Let's go back now to the day that Michael Brown was killed. That was a normal day, and you were working at the time, correct?
No, actually, it was a Saturday afternoon, and I was off.
Okay, so how did you get notified about the shooting?
My sergeant called. He was at the scene, and he let me know that we had an officer-involved shooting, fatality, and that a crowd was gathering, because it was in sort of a housing projects area of the town, you know, densely populated area. And, you know, crowd was gathering and they were getting hostile and the situation was getting bad and they were calling for help from other agencies.
So when you got that call, you decided to respond?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I headed right for town, but along the way, since, you know, we're a small agency and we have a big agency nearby, St. Louis County Police Department, where I came from, and whose police chief is a close personal friend and colleague. So while I was on the way, I gave him a call, Chief Belmer, and told him what I had and asked him if he would handle the investigation. And he, of course, said that he would.
You mean the investigation of the officer-involved shooting?
Yes, yeah.
Right, and that's pretty much standard protocol, right? You don't, because of the size of your agency, the expertise that St. Louis County has is much greater.
Sure, and of course, I have, you know, very good detectives, and they were well-qualified, but this is one of those things where you not only want to do it right, but you want the community to have confidence that you're doing it right.
Yeah, right. That's a nice thought, right?
That was a nice thought until the state and federal government moved in. Yeah.
Just one quick question before we go on. Officer-involved shootings must be fairly rare in your community, correct?
Oh, correct. Yeah. Yeah. The last one we had, I don't know. Yeah, it was well before my time. The last fatal officer-involved shooting we had, and you know, it was probably 10 years or more, and that officer actually took two bullets to the vest before he returned fire.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a rarity.
Yeah. So when you got to the scene, what greeted you? What was the scene like when you first got there?
Well, it was chaotic. There were people everywhere. Officers were trying to put up the yellow tape, and but the crowd was building and angry. They were milling around, but it was, you know, it was a very, very volatile situation. A county commander had arrived there before me, and he put out a call. What we call here is a code 1000. It's a controlled call for additional help from other agencies. So we had lots of police officers coming. But we had a situation that was looking like it could potentially get out of control.
Right. Now, let's go back. I know that there's still litigation taking place. So there's certain areas where you can't make any comment on. But let me, for the listeners, let me kind of encapsulate about the shooting of Michael Brown.
Okay.
Officer Darren Wilson was a veteran officer. He was on patrol, and he was in a marked police car in full uniform. And Michael Brown and his friend Dorian Johnson, I believe was his name, did a strong-arm robbery in a convenience store. They Michael Brown was a huge man, over six foot five, like 300 pounds, big guy. And he went into a convenience store, stole some cigarillos, pushed the clerk around a little bit, and did a felony strong arm robbery. They left the store and they're walking down the middle of the street when Officer Darren Wilson spotted them. A radio report had gone out giving their description, and they were also walking in the middle of the street. Officer Wilson approached them, and Michael Brown attacked Darren Wilson. He literally put his body into the police car, punched Darren Wilson, and then tried to disarm him of his service weapon. During that struggle, Darren Wilson fired a round, and that round struck Brown in the hand, I believe. And all of this, by the way, was verified through DNA evidence and forensic examinations later on. But this is the actual story, is that Brown was the aggressor. Brown was attacking the officer. After the initial confrontation inside the patrol car, Brown turned and ran. Darren Wilson got out to pursue. Brown then turned around and charged Darren Wilson, who discharged his weapon several times, striking Brown and killing him. That is the reality, that that Darren Wilson is the victim. Darren Wilson was attacked by this huge man. Darren Wilson defended himself and used deadly force as he was trained to do and as he had every right to do. That does that pretty much summarize what took place?
Yeah, you've got it there. Everything that happened is of course a matter of public record. Although the powers that be sought really hard to change that narrative, and they actually were successful in changing the way the perception of what happened was.
Well, now that began with the greatest fiction I think that has ever affected police work, and that is hands up, don't shoot.
I know, Randy, and that story hit the press pretty quickly. I don't know why they put it out so quickly without verifying anything, that went out. It went viral right away. And of course, if I believe that's what really happened, I'd be angry too. But it's not what happened. But it is the story that went out there, and it stayed out there. And we were never able to pull it back or to get ahead of it or to really, get anybody to listen to the truth or even to wait for the investigation to flush out what happened.
Did any of the media, before they ran with this hands up, don't shoot narrative, did anybody from the media contact you and ask you if that's what happened?
No, I was on the scene for quite a while when I got a call from my boss, and he was telling me what was going out over the airways, and he said that that they were saying that nobody from the police department was talking to him. Well, at that point, I went over to the press. We had a really volatile situation, and I didn't even realize that the press was there, other than they were way back behind, amongst the crowd. But I went back over there and just gave them a preliminary statement. But it was really too late.
Yeah. So they ran with it immediately, and that became a firestorm of controversy. So. That is right after the initial shooting. You're at the scene, and you get the information that this tale is going out over the airwaves about the hands up, don't shoot. And what's the crowd doing about this point?
Oh, they're getting more and more angry. They're yelling, the usual F the police kind of rhetoric. And at that point, though, they were still seemed to be honoring the yellow tape for the most part. We hadn't moved over to that moment of anarchy that we had later. But what also was happening is we had several times when there was gunfire back behind us, which we were never, because the crowd was so big, we were never really able to find out where that came from.
Right, right. Now, there has been criticism from certain elements about how long Michael Brown's body was left at the scene. And I think that was a good time to explain what the procedures are so that people understand why that body was left there. So please go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Well, there were basically just a couple, three factors that went into why that was the case. One was, since the county police department was handling the investigation, they were also going to handle the forensics and the crime scene and all that. So it took them, they were actually processing a hostage situation that happened in the opposite end of St. Louis County, which is 45 miles away. And so it was I think after 2 o'clock. It was about 2 hours before they even got there. And then they had two areas, one where the body was and one where the initial assault took place, which was in the police car. And so they had a big area. They had a lot of angles to look at and stuff to process. And on top of that, over near where the body was, we had these occasions where there were shots ringing out. so it really wasn't a stable, protected scene. So although, you know, it was a long time for the body to be in the street, and, you know, that fed into the anger and the mistrust and all of that. And it is so much that long after this, in January of last year, I believe it was, I was invited to speak at Harvard Law School with a roundtable discussion, which turned into a disaster. But there was a St. Louis University law professor there who was on the dais with me, and he actually said to this crowd of people that I personally, me, left the body in the street for that period of time to intimidate the other people in the community.
Oh, that's nice.
Yep,
that's
law nice. Professor. Yeah.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, that's the same Harvard Law School that that our president was at, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was. I think it was.
Okay, just a little aside there, that's all. So in essence, simply you were following the proper procedures and policies that were necessary to do a complete and thorough criminal investigation.
That's right. Yeah, we're just doing our jobs, and we became the bad guys.
So now that the evening is coming, mm-hmm. and describe the scene for us. What was taking place?
It almost became like a carnival atmosphere. There were people everywhere, just milling around. Of course, yelling at the police, confronting the police. Blocking the streets, you know, just wandering around. And this went on, you know, through the night. You know, hundreds of people just kept coming into the area. And, you know, of course, normally in these kinds of things, you would expect that the crowd eventually would disperse. But, which sort of happened, you know, into the early morning hours, but then the crowd began to develop again and much, much bigger on Sunday, the following day. And it just kept growing.
Were rounds continuing to be fired throughout all this?
Yeah, periodically we have gunfire. Then it would settle down for a while. But, you know, then as it got into Sunday evening, that's when things really turned on us. You know, that's when the whole world changed, really, at least for us. You know, we had, I don't know how many hundreds of people that had gathered, and you know, we had, you know, dozens and dozens of police officers and SWAT teams from surrounding communities who were now there trying to set up skirmish lines, and we were surrounded by massive crowds on three sides that were beginning to, I guess, feel empowered just by the sheer size of the crowd that was growing. And they became more and more violent, and then, you know, the shots started ringing out, the rocks started flying, and, you know, once we had enough police officers there, the decision was made that that we were going to disperse this crowd. And, you know, once we started dispersing the crowd scattered in all directions, but not without leaving, you know, tremendous destruction in its wake, you know, lighting things on fire, destroying businesses, looting, destroying cars, and it just traveled for miles in all directions.
Who were you at that time? Who was making the tactical decisions?
So that's a rule in our area, and I was a tactical commander myself with the county. Once you call in the county SWAT team, you hand over control of that particular situation to them. But also, one of the other problems was this had spread into the unincorporated area of St. Louis County and into neighboring communities that were patrolled by St. Louis County. And it just, it scattered like wildfire. And I was then, actually the county police chief, John Bellman, was there with me. And, you know, we ended up, you know, trying to chase down some of these looters as well. We went down to the Walmart when that got looted. We got a call that it was being looted and people were trapped inside. When we went down there, we had a pickup truck drive past us and a handgun come out the window and several rounds were fired.
So it was basically complete anarchy.
It was, yeah, it was anarchy, it was chaos, it was this complete lawlessness, and it just went on all night long. But we were aggressive in pursuing, you know, the looters, and we made numerous arrests that night. But there were just way too many people for us to control it.
Did when did you make contact with your governor about possible National Guard backup?
That was within a couple of days. The National Guard came out, but they pulled them back pretty quickly. And we had a meeting with the governor, and he said that, you know, he wasn't going to be sending the National Guard out; that it was all going to be handled in blue.
Let's talk about what your interactions were with the governor and the role that he played in this mess. Go ahead and just let loose with this.
I would say that the role that the governor played was of a pandering politician, a great example of epic failure on leadership. At one point he defamed myself and the county police chief and put said he was putting the highway patrol in charge, but he put a captain from the highway patrol in charge, not the superintendent, not a major, you know, not a colonel, a captain who happened to be African American. The governor apparently thought that would quell the crowds, and of course, you know, that wasn't the case. The chaos remained, but he also had us essentially standing down and letting the looters loot and let them block the streets and do what they needed to do to get it out of their system. And
so, in essence, he did the same thing that the Baltimore mayor did.
Oh yeah.
When she said, just give them the corridor to express themselves or some nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like that. The governor also came into town and let everybody know that there was going to be a vigorous prosecution in this case. Not that he had any control over that, but you know, he was the, I think, I don't know if it was him or Eric Holder, was the first one to essentially declare that this was a bad shooting and that they were going to get the officer.
Well, you mean a prosecution of Officer Darren Wilson?
Oh yeah.
Not of the looters.
No.
So, did the governor accomplish anything that was positive during this entire mess?
No, I can't think of anything other than took himself out of contention for a potential vice presidential nomination.
We'll look upon that as a positive.
Yeah, that's a positive. But
didn't he in fact cut off contact with you?
Yes. Yeah, he cut off contact with the city completely.
And I noticed, you know, one of the things that when I was watching the coverage of this, I saw a lot of police officers that did not have protective gear on.
Yeah, that was ordered when he declared a state of emergency and put his man in charge. That was one of the things, you know, we don't want the optics to look bad. We don't want to look like what Claire McCaskill called the militarized police. So, but the officers rebelled against that. But yeah, they were essentially put out there unprotected for a while, and it was really upside down. You know, with me and my commanders, you know, officer safety was always first, and that was the same with Chief Belmer. That you know, with the governor declaring a state of emergency and putting someone else in charge, it made it a very contentious situation for a while.
So even though this was in St. Louis County, and the chief of the St. Louis Police Department was there, you're the chief of that particular town. It was the governor's decision to put a captain from the highway patrol in charge of this incident.
Yes.
Have you ever in your entire 34 year police career ever heard of anything that insane?
No, it was just the first of many missteps by the governor that fed into this all the way up till the end, you know, when he just let the town burn. But he really turned his back on the community, and and he was clearly, in our view, getting his marching orders from D.C.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You think that he was in strong communication with the White House and the Department of Justice?
I think he was in communication with somebody from D.C., and I don't know whether it was coming through one of the senators or through congressmen or the Justice Department, but the marching orders were what he was doing was inconsistent with the best interests of the community and officer safety. Yeah, and then of course, you know, during that first week, the Attorney General of the United States came into Ferguson. Didn't talk to any Ferguson officials, didn't talk to me. But the Attorney General of the United States came in and all but said that, you know, this was a bad police shooting and that he was gonna make it right.
So the entire time that Eric Holder, who was the Attorney General of the United States,
yeah,
whole time that he was in your area, he never reached out to law enforcement.
Only to the captain from the Highway Patrol. He stopped in at the command post. You know, as far as sitting down with us, the people, you know, actually the administration, city of Ferguson, no, not
that's
at all.
That's astounding.
It really was, yeah.
Did you ever have any interference from President Obama that you're aware of, or did he do it through Eric Holder?
No, he did it through Eric Holder. It was, you know, more of the same. You know, when he said something about it, it was, you know, police bad. And, you know, he was always quick to blame the cops.
During this this incident lasted how long approximately?
Let's see, August 9th, and then the grand jury decision was November 24th, I believe, and, you know, then that's when the really massive destruction took place, and the governor and the all the government abandoned us completely, and then it probably went on pretty intensely into January. And then in March, after I resigned, I actually had two officers were shot on my station parking lot.
This was just this was a piece of police history that has never occurred before.
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. Police were thrown under the bus. Bad guys became good guys, and you know, the police became the bad guys. I had a Justice Department attorney tell me at one point that. That the police place too much emphasis on personal responsibility.
He did what?
Yeah. And Department of Justice attorney said he placed too much emphasis on personal responsibility.
Okay. I guess that's what happens when you get a higher education, I suppose.
I suppose, yeah.
Did when things started really heating up, And the violence took place. Did you make attempts to get the National Guard to play a really active role in trying to protect the community from the looting and the burning?
Yeah, we were told early on that the National Guard was not going to be deployed anymore. But then, as we got close to as this thing played out, and there was, you know, the regular nightly violence and the shooting and, you know, the attacks on the police and all that stuff, as it got closer to grand jury decision time, the governor declared another state of emergency and said that he was going to deploy National Guard. And as a matter of fact, I was told that I would have as much National Guard in Ferguson as I needed, you know, prior to this, and that I shouldn't worry about that. And then not too long after that, Chief Belmar told me that the governor was not going to deploy the National Guard in the city of Ferguson. They were going to be in the city of St. Louis. They were going to be in the county seat of Clayton. But they would not be in Ferguson, which is where all the violence was anticipated to take place.
How many businesses were destroyed as a result of this violence?
Oh, 26 were burned, destroyed by burning, and there were probably at least that many that were, you know, damaged with looting, broken glass, and things like that. And then entire car lots, there was a rental car lot, and all the cars were burned on that. Police cars were burned. The destruction was incredible, especially for the small size of the area that we were dealing with.
Who do you blame for that destruction?
Oh, wow. There's, you know, first of all, there's a whole personal responsibility. The people that did it are first and foremost to blame. But, you know, that's a fire that got fueled, and the fuel came from politicians and from the Justice Department. And, you know, I blame Eric Holder for a big part of it. I blame the governor for not doing the right thing, and that's, you know, let us take control. You know, we needed to restore order, because that's what the police do. You know, we keep order, we preserve the peace, and we are not allowed to do that. And, you know, I blame to a large extent the press that would actually be there and see what was going on and see these officers standing on a line with hundreds of people yelling insults at them, threatening to murder their babies and rape their wives and, you know, all kinds of stuff on a daily basis, threatening to kill them, throwing urine at them. And the press was calling this peaceful protests. And the Justice Department lawyers were calling it peaceful protests. You know, that's so... Here we are using military tactics against peaceful protesters. That's the fuel, really, that fanned these flames.
In your opinion, could this violence have been stopped early on?
Yeah, we were doing a good job of it until the governor took over. You know, I mean, it looked like, you know, chaos, but we were arresting people on a regular basis, and you know, we were dispersing the crowds. You know, we were sending out tear gas when they started, you know, when the gunfire started. So, you know, we were using tried and true police tactics to restore order, because that was our job. When we were told that we weren't really going to be doing that anymore, that empowered the, you know, when they took the softer approach, that empowered the mobs.
Yeah.
And of course, by then it was like Woodstock. You know, everybody from around the country wanted to come.
You know, let's touch on that for a moment. There was a time later on in this game when out of town protesters were being bussed in.
Oh yeah, there was big money going into this. The local newspaper talked about you know, they tracked down money going back to, for example, George Soros, millions of dollars that were being paid to various organizations. And I mean, the protesters, a bunch of them told us, you know, because during the day, you know, I'd go out and talk to some of these protesters and actually, you know, turn some of them around, you know, and got them to do more positive things. But some of them, you know, they're like, we're not going anywhere. We're getting paid $15 an hour to be here. So, you know, they were there to keep inciting violence. And, you know, there were all kinds of organizations started showing up. We had the old Black Panthers, the new Black Panthers. We had Black Lives Matter, you know, the other anarchist groups, Anonymous. Everybody you could possibly imagine was showing up there. Palestinian organizations. Oh, yeah, with the Nation of Islam there. And, of course, then, you know, the national rabble-rousers showed up, like Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson.
Of course.
Yeah, we even had Flava Flav show up to protest.
So at the end of the day, you were forced to resign, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, once the Justice Department came out with that ridiculous report that they wrote, which I wish we were taking to litigation.
Yeah, the reality is that they hold the purse strings, and for a small community like Ferguson to combat that that report would cost the city millions of dollars.
Yeah, and they can say whatever they want. They're at one point they said, well, yeah, if we go to litigation, we're going to have to verify some of this stuff. You know, when we were in the meeting with them, they told us what this report was going to say. There was one point where our attorney said, "Well, you can't say that. You can't do that. It won't stand up at our litigation." And their attorney said, "Well, we're not litigating, are we?"
So they were basically rubbing your face in it.
Yeah, they were saying, "Well, we didn't get you, but we got you."
Yeah, exactly. So they because they made every possible effort to try and prosecute Darren Wilson, did they not?
Well, there's the advantage there. The FBI is part of the Justice Department, but they don't. It's been my experience that they don't kowtow to them, at least not in this area. So two advantages for Darren there is one, the FBI is bound by the rules of law and probable cause. So in order to prosecute him, they had to be able to prove that he did something wrong, which was not the case. With the Justice Department's Special Litigations Unit, they don't have to do that. You know, they told us, they said there doesn't have to be bias, and we don't have to prove bias. We just have to show the appearance of bias. Well, how easy is that?
Incredible. How is Officer Wilson doing now?
He's doing okay. I talk to him from time to time. And, you know, of course, you know, there's a young man that never wanted to be anything but a cop. And, you know, now he's not going to be able to do that.
So he and you are really the true victims of the incident at Ferguson.
Well, you know, just there's so many of these officers that were traumatized by what they were having to face every single day, you know, and they were coming from the county and the state and all the surrounding municipalities that came out there to help. So, you know, I couldn't just say it's just me or Darren. It was everybody that suffered greatly from this this savage attack on the police.
And I think that the effects of this will be felt for many, many years to come in the world of policing. Is there if you could address Eric Holder right now, what would you say to him?
Oh, you can't put that out here.
I hear you.
You know, there was one point where, and I actually went on CNN and said this, but he was complaining that, you know, there were leaks coming out about the investigation. He just wished people would keep their big mouths shut. And then he said that, you know, with this investigation of Ferguson ongoing, he said, yeah, there needs to be wholesale change in that town.
Yeah, you know? I mean, right.
How about you wait till your investigation's done, which was already done. He declared it long before the investigation started.
Exactly.
As a matter of fact, when we sat down with the attorneys the very first time they came out and they were talking about whether or not there was going to be a pattern and practice investigation, and this is, you know, very early on in all the goings-on, and so, you know, I told them what I told you at the beginning of our talk today, you know, about how the community was, you know, and all the good things we had going on. They said, well, you know, we're going to go back to D.C. We'll talk about it for a couple of weeks, and then we'll let you know if we're going to do what we're going to do, if anything at all. I said, that's great. So I walked out of that meeting into the parking lot, and CNN was there, of course. And when the CNN reporters said, we're just hearing out of Eric Holder's office that they're opening a pattern and practice investigation on you. So that was the quickest 2 weeks I ever heard.
Yeah. You know, the fix was in.
Yeah, it was already done.
Right. Well, you know, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. We're running out of time. And Tom, I think your insight into the truth of what took place in Ferguson will help law enforcement officers understand what you guys were facing and the impossible task that you were given with incredible amount of political interference that interfered with policing to the point where rendered it basically ineffective. And I want to thank you once again for coming on this program. And I understand that you're writing a book about it.
I am, yeah. Just getting started on it. We're well into it. And I hope to have it out, or have it finished by the end of the year anyway.
That's great. Well, once it comes out, we'll make sure we get you back on and we can talk about that book.
Oh, I'd love to.
Thanks again, and best of luck to you in the future.
Same to you, Randy. It's good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
Bye.
I'm happy to report that there is no segment on End of Watch this week. That means no law enforcement officers lost their lives in the line of duty. I really appreciate you listening to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I think that this particular segment is very, very important for people to share so that the American people understand how the effects of Ferguson really took place and how the political power structure from the president all the way to Eric Holder played such a tremendous role in the disruption of that community and the future of policing. Have a great week. You can please follow me on Twitter at Lieutenant Randy Sutton and on Facebook. Go to Randy Sutton, public figure. I love to have your comments and your questions and follow the daily activities of law enforcement all over this country. Thanks. See you next week.